Do you owe $10,000 or more on at least two federal student loans? Then you may qualify for new programs offered by the Department of Education. These programs can reduce your interest, lower your payments, and possibly qualify you for loan forgiveness. If you have $10,000 or more and at least two federal student loans and currently not in school, you may qualify for one of these programs. Call now to check your eligibility. Student loan advisors are standing by to help you determine if you qualify for these new programs. They can help you reduce your interest, lower your payment, and even forgive a portion of your student loan debt. Take control of your financial future. Make this free 5-minute free call now to Nationwide Student Loans and learn how you can reduce your student loan debt.
800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588. 800-439-1588.
From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. A look inside the secret intelligence briefings of presidents from JFK to Obama, with a President's Daily Brief intel officer under Presidents Clinton and Bush 43. That's today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. David Priest served during the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations as an award-winning CIA intelligence officer and daily intelligence briefer. He also served as a desk officer at the State Department. The new book, The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. Honored to have you, David.
Pleasure to be here, Jim. Thank you.
Taking us inside the office, and I'm, of course, as a business show, fascinated by the different style and organization of the various presidents, how they use the PDB, the President's Daily Brief. To start off with our listeners, tell us sort of what it is, the amount of prep that goes into it, and what a typical briefing would be like.
Yeah, the President's Daily Brief is the daily document that has gone to each commander-in-chief for the past 50-plus years in one form or another. A lot about it is summarized in the name itself, President's Daily Brief. First, it's the President's. It's the President's book. It is aimed for, tailored for, the current sitting president, which means that over the past 50 years, it has changed in its format, in its style of delivery, based on the desires of the president. The second word, daily. It is produced every working day for the president. Some presidents have wanted it 7 days a week. Most want it 5 or 6 days a week. But in that sense, it is like a classified, top-secret newspaper, in that there have to be items in the book for the president each day, because he's expecting to see it. The third word there, of course, is brief, and that means that the schedule of the world's most powerful person is measured in minutes, and the document that goes to him every day has to be brief. Usually, it's been less than 20 pages of the most compelling analysis and information of information going on around the globe on national security affairs. That means that it has to pack a whole lot into a short amount of space. So there's definitely a premium in the preparation for it of getting the president only what he needs to know and nothing that he does not need to know when it comes to analysis of national security threats and opportunities.
And you would start the prep for this in the middle of the night? How many folks would be involved?
Sure. When I worked on this, and I think this is typical with some variation across the years, we would get in the middle of the night. And our job would be to look at the drafts of the pieces that were going into the president's book, which then, of course, would be briefed also to the handful of other senior officials the president had designated to receive it. We would look at that material, make sure we were comfortable talking to the issues, answering some of the first-tier questions coming from the information on the printed page. And then mostly, depending on your customer and their needs, you would supplement that information with other pieces of intelligence that had been written up by intelligence analysts or other raw intelligence information, that is, the reports from the spies in the field or from the listening posts themselves.
And we're going to dig a little deeper, but because you worked in Bill Clinton and George W. Bush's, to me, they're incredibly different in their sort of intellectual thought process. Clinton might be someone that might be considered professorial, maybe indecisive, but gathering all kinds of data, and Bush is known as kind of impulsive. Did you see fundamentally different ways that they absorbed the briefings?
Well, I did not brief both of them, the president's daily brief, but I did work with those who did, and I did interview not only those who provided the intelligence to them, but also got input for this book from President Clinton and President Bush themselves. The biggest difference between the two of them, honestly, was in their ability to keep a schedule. Bill Clinton could not stick to a meeting. He would want to get into the details. He would not let things go. His staff would be looking at the clock, looking at him, virtually pulling him out of the room. But he was operating on what became known as Bill Clinton time. Therefore, it was very hard to schedule briefings for him because they would simply get pushed back as other business went later and later. So during his 8 years as president, Bill Clinton's brief went in an ebb and flow between getting briefed or just reading it. The difference with George W. Bush was astounding. George W. Bush kept to a very tight schedule and kept things precise, but he also reserved time every morning for a working-level CIA briefer to come in and lead a discussion of the contents in the book so that he could read it and get immediate feedback from questions and get immediate supplemental information right there in the session itself.
Do you think that the way you just explained that, that would say Bush was doing a better job, or you really can't make that statement because the presidents absorb the way their personalities and org styles work?
I think it's really more the latter. I think that it is foolish for us to say that one size fits all when it comes to how a president should receive information. Let's face it, Jim, by the time somebody gets to the Oval Office, they've probably worked out a style of information flow that works pretty well for them, or they wouldn't have gotten to that point. But there is a value to be had of having a briefer in the room. Without that, you hope that the bureaucracy works in terms of getting the questions to who needs them and getting clarification on what the president needs. When you have a briefer in the room, much easier to get that direct feedback from customer number one, the president of the United States.
What, in your estimation, which president made the best use of it and which made the least? And again, we're talking between the period of JFK through Obama.
Right. Again, it does depend on the personality of the presidents. All of the ones that I got information from directly for this book, and that's Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, all of them say that they used it well, but they had very different styles. Jimmy Carter tended to read it and then talk to his national security advisor about it, did not see a CIA briefer at any point in his presidency after day one.
Wow.
Bill Clinton went back and forth. Both Presidents Bush did see a CIA briefer during their entire time in office. Because of that, there was a much richer, deeper interaction with the material. Who's to say whether the other presidents would have been better served by that or not? All things equal, it seems to make sense. But frankly, if you're more of a reader than you are a listener, then forcing you to be briefed because that tends to work better probably does you a disservice.
How do you assess the net value? Is it as a predictor, avoiding crises? Is it just surfacing the right information? How would you assess the net impact or value of this PDB?
At its best, it is all of those. And at its worst, it fails at all of those. It is very hard to predict certain events overseas. A coup is a good example. If the government in question does not know that it's about to be overthrown, when they have all of the law enforcement and intelligence tools at their disposal in the country itself, it's folly to think that American intelligence is going to be able to predict it much better than that. On the other hand, that is the job of intelligence analysis, to take things that are unknown and to impose some order on them so that the president can make better decisions about threats and opportunities. When the president's daily brief has worked well, it has done a remarkable job of giving insight into the personalities that the president will be dealing with and the events overseas that he will be reacting to. When it has failed spectacularly. And a dramatic case from the book is the story of the October 1973 war when Egypt invaded Israel. No one predicted that, and that includes the president's daily brief itself, such that even the morning of the attack, there was nothing in the president's daily report saying that this was going to happen.
All right, we'll come back to more questions as we go along, and now we'll jump in and throw some presidents in as well.
Sure.
Let's start, obviously, with President Kennedy.
Right.
And interesting that he basically couldn't sit still, so you guys designed it around that. Tell us the Kennedy stories.
Yeah, back to John Kennedy. His advisors were really frustrated when he came into office because he was bouncing around from topic to topic, couldn't seem to sit still for long. Some of his advisors said that they tried to give him an actual full briefing, and he was rocking in his chair, full of impatience and ready to jump out the door at any minute. So they tried the next best thing, which is give him a stack of intelligence documents from all of the agencies and departments that play into national security. Apparently, that stack got pretty tall, and they noticed that it was still sitting on the desk in the Oval Office at the end of the day, apparently unread. So they asked in two CIA analysts and said, what we really need is one document that will take everything that is in all of these documents that the president really needs to know and put them in one place. And tell you what, let's put it into a format that the president will like. That is, none of this dense bureaucratic prose, none of these classification markings that look like alphabet soup. Let's just have it presented cleanly. The CIA analysts loved the idea. 2 days later, Kennedy was reading the inaugural copy of it on the diving board of the swimming pool at the rented estate the Kennedy family had out in Middleburg, Virginia. It seemed to work for Kennedy, something he could fold, put in his suit pocket, carry around with him during the day to read when he had time.
I was interested that McGeorge Bundy was able to be blunt enough to tell Kennedy that, you know, basically this stuff, we're dysfunctionally organized. We can't get your attention to anything. In the remaining few seconds that we have, tell us the story. He liked to gather Kennedy intimate kinds of details, too, rumors, scandals.
He did. There's a couple of cases that I was able to find where he seemed to enjoy things like a report of what a German minister sounded like when he was drunk. He seemed to enjoy the report of a Brazilian leader who apparently had his wife's lover killed. These are the kinds of things that you could put into a colloquial document made just for the president himself that might not make it through bureaucratic review if it's going to thousands of people in the U.S. government.
Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Business Talk Radio Network, 350 affiliates around the country. Next, we'll explore some more presidents and their daily intel briefings.
I've owned my company for 14 years now, and I can tell you that payroll is a four-letter word. I hate doing it. It eats up hours I don't have, and it costs me money I could be saving. But my accountant's too expensive, and I'm not sure who to call. But I know I need help.
We're Paychex, and we take all the hassles out of small business payroll. We save you time and money. It's easy. Call, fax, or give us your payroll information securely online, and we take care of the rest. We calculate the correct taxes, manage payments and direct deposits. We even send out your checks. Payroll doesn't need to be a four-letter word anymore. We're so sure that we can save you time and money that we'll give you a month's payroll free. Just for calling 877-726-3369. Get 1 month's payroll for free. Call Paychex right now. 877-726-3369. That's 877-726-3369.
Hi, I'm Joan London. If you're worried about your parent or loved one living alone, like I was, and you want reliable senior care information, then call A Place for Mom, the nation's largest senior living referral service.
Finding an apartment that was on the courtyard with the view of the trees, the view of the ducks, the stream, the creek, all of that, that was what I needed.
You'll get free information on assisted living, Alzheimer's care, nursing homes, even important financial information. Here's the number.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
A Place for Mom is a free service, and you can trust them to help you. So if you're struggling to find reliable senior living information, there's a place for answers, A Place for Mom.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
Have you written a book and want to get it published? Then call Page Publishing ASAP. We're looking for authors of all types of books. And unlike most publishers, Page Publishing will take the time to review each and every book submitted to us. And we'll give you our feedback. And if we like what we read, we will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, the Apple iTunes Store, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. We handle everything. Editing, cover design, copyright protection, printing, publicity, and distribution. So if you've written a novel, children's book, cookbook, inspirational work, poetry, or a biography and want to get it published, Call Page Publishing now for your free author submission kit. Your road to fame and fortune could very well start with this simple phone call.
888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. 888-785-0618. That's 888-785-0618.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. That's 800-430-7570.
Biz Talk Radio.
And we're back with former Presidential Daily Intelligence Briefer David Priest. Moving along with some of the other presidents now, on LBJ, you've already talked about the 67 war that kind of snuck through. But I was interested in kind of a smaller arcane thing. There was a mention that in the brief of Lee Harvey Oswald after the assassination and that he'd been in Mexico and Cuba. Did that elicit worries of conspiracy or anything, or was it meant to just, it's just a data point?
Seemed like it was the latter, just a data point. Back in those days, this is before it was even called the President's Daily Brief, that first document produced for John Kennedy, they called it the President's Intelligence Checklist, which, if you think about it, makes an awkward acronym, PICL. Immediately, CIA became known as the Pickle Factory because of that. In the pickle, there was a note on November 25th, 1963, which said, press stories to the effect that Lee Harvey Oswald recently visited Mexico City are true, according to our information. Oswald visited both the Cuban and the Soviet embassies on 28 September. And that's about it. It was merely a mention for the president at this point, Lyndon Johnson, of what it was from the CIA's information was relevant to the information about Oswald that was coming out at the time.
All right, Nixon now, an interesting one from two ways. One, he didn't seem to get along very well with the CIA, which you can talk about. And the other is Kissinger really exerted a tremendous control. There was even a big time lag between the time that it would even get to Nixon.
Yeah, it's fascinating in the documentary record that I was able to dig out. There was a memo that Kissinger asked for that he asked his then aide, Alexander Haig, to look into the practice of the president's intelligence briefing and the daily documentation for the Johnson administration, which Nixon was following. And Kissinger didn't like it. And so what he decided to do is to have the president's daily brief delivered to the White House by 5:30 in the afternoon, the day before it was supposed to go to the president. That would give Kissinger a chance to look at it, to see anything he didn't like, to react to it, to write a memo that counteracted those points. It also meant that by the time President Nixon saw the daily brief in the morning, it was at least 17 hours delayed in terms of the amount of information in it, perhaps not the best use of the U.S. government resources in a timely fashion.
Did the CIA feel that Nixon had it out for them? And then, of course, Watergate, when that emerged, the CIA, he tried to use the CIA.
Certainly, and certainly the director pushed back on that and was one of the heroes of Watergate, in fact, by not allowing the Nixon White House to push the FBI off of the case, claiming it was a CIA operation. The folks who worked at the CIA at the time, whom I interviewed for the book, almost to a person said the Nixon years were not good years for what's called current intelligence. That is the day-to-day intelligence that goes to policymakers to help them with immediate decisions, because they felt that Nixon and Kissinger, too, did not appreciate what they were doing. The remarkable thing was they didn't like it, but they kept doing it. They realized their job was to serve the presidency, even if they disagreed with the way that the president himself was dealing with it.
Now, President Ford, and you could probably attach this to Truman as well, didn't really have access to all the intel. He was only newly installed. And so in that case, the CIA also sort of serves as a tutoring organization, right, to bring him up to speed.
That's right. That's right. And actually, they did a good job just before he became president of reading the language on the wall. The winds of Watergate were blowing pretty strong by the summer of 1974. And Gerald Ford, as vice president, happened to take a tour of the CIA. The director, Bill Colby, walked him through the current intelligence office where the president's daily brief happened to be sitting there. At that point, only President Nixon and the National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, were seeing it. Ford had not been seeing this document. He noticed it there. Colby said, "Would you like to see this?" And Ford said, "Of course." They actually got a working-level briefer to start briefing Ford at his house in Alexandria and in the back of his car on the way into downtown Washington, D.C., building a relationship that would continue when Ford moved into the Oval Office in August of 1974.
Fascinating. Jimmy Carter, a couple of things interested me there. Number one, it seemed like Brzezinski sort of put himself against sort of Kissinger, like in the way, sort of blocking the CIA from any direct. Admiral Turner was in his class at the Naval Academy, but didn't seem to get any special access at all because of that.
That's right. Jimmy Carter had real respect for Admiral Stansfield Turner, but it really didn't matter because the person who had the closest access to Carter was Zbigniew Brzezinski. So on Inauguration Day, January 20th, the CIA briefer who had been working with Ford dutifully hand-carried the president's daily brief to Jimmy Carter, and it was the first time he would deliver the PDB to the president during that four-year term. It was also the very last time because Zbigniew Brzezinski on the calendar crossed out the word intelligence briefing and wrote in national security briefing, and he just incorporated the president's daily brief into his daily meeting with Jimmy Carter.
That's amazing. This may be a small thing to you, but it hit me. Jimmy Carter, of course, was an outsider, supposedly had zero knowledge of foreign policy, and while he was a candidate, he was getting briefed, and right. He was actually asking questions. This impressed me about the Sunni-Shia issues, mm-hmm. something that President George W. Bush was rumored to not really have a good grasp on before the Iraq War.
Well, this is something that isn't well known about the briefing process for presidential candidates and presidents. When a president is elected, at that point, the president-elect is brought into the PDB process. That is, in order to prepare the president-elect for the duties of office come January, the CIA for decades has been briefing the president-elect on the same material that the president, who is about to leave office, has been seeing. Jimmy Carter took it a step further. He requested briefings from the CIA not only after being elected, not only after the conventions, when typically the candidates are briefed on lesser issues than the president's daily brief. He even asked for a CIA briefing before he was nominated so that he could get up to speed on these issues.
All right, let's turn to President Reagan now, because this was interesting to me, too, because Reagan's image was someone that left the details for others. How did he use the PDP and get along with the CIA?
Well, it's even stronger than the fact that he didn't go into the details, Jim. A lot of conventional wisdom has it that Reagan didn't read much of anything, much less serious material like current intelligence on top secret issues. But based on the research and those who knew him most closely, it's pretty clear he took his intelligence reading quite seriously. In fact, a CIA historian went back and reviewed the first 1,000 or so of Reagan's PDBs, which the CIA keeps in classified storage. His report out from that was that there were plenty of marks on Reagan's copy showing underlines, exclamation points, brackets clearly in his hand, questions written in the margin, in some cases even corrections of typos and things that didn't add up correctly. These are not the signs of someone who did not read the report carefully.
Very, very interesting. President George H.W. Bush, now there's one that's got to be interesting because he ran the CIA, and he would have obviously known also the strengths and weaknesses. Did he structure his PDP when he got in the executive office around both his the way he wanted to look at things and maybe to work with the parts that he didn't like or felt were weaker in the CIA?
Sure. He actually took it to a new level. I mentioned Gerald Ford had a working-level CIA briefer with him, but he only did that for his first year in office until he felt he got up to speed. George H.W. Bush was the first president for his entire term to take a working-level CIA briefer working with him on the president's daily brief every morning. That is probably based on the fact of his comfort with the material when he was the director of Central Intelligence back in the 70s, but it also shows the value he placed on getting the intelligence before making some very important foreign policy decisions during his administration, having to do with the invasion of Iraq after the invasion of Kuwait and the fall of the Soviet Union.
And you can go to CampbellBizTalk.com, sign up for our weekly email blast, find out who our guests are every week. You can advertise on it as well for your own business. And coming next, we'll finish up on the presidents. We'll look at some Intel failures as well.
Have you heard about BizTV? BizTV is the home for America's entrepreneurs, small businesses, and those who want to succeed in life. It's the only national television network committed to airing original, high-quality, educational, and inspirational programming about real business people. BizTV can provide the right kind of ideas, motivation, and education to help fuel the next generation of business owners. Visit BizTV.com and call your satellite or cable service provider to request BizTV.
We paid less for our Craftmatic today than we did 20 years ago.
If you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and free information on today's Craftmatic adjustable beds. And then decide when you see how little they cost. Rated number one by consumers nationwide on ConsumerAffairs.com. Craftmatic beds come in all mattress types, including cool gel memory foam for up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand. Enjoy temporary relief of low back pain, poor circulation, nighttime heartburn, mild arthritis. You'll sleep better in a Craftmatic adjustable bed. So if you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and information, and then decide when you see how little they cost. Discover Craftmatic for less, up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand.
Call 1-800-316-5271. That's 1-800-316-5271. 1-800-316-5271. Call now.
Hi, I'm George Foreman. Do you have an idea for a new product or invention? People ask me all the time, George, how do I get my idea in front of companies? How do I get a patent? What do I do next? Do you have the same questions? I'll tell you like I'll tell them all. Call my friends at InventHelp.
Call InventHelp today for free information. InventHelp can submit your invention to companies who are interested in receiving new ideas.
To get your free inventor's information, call 1-800-352-3719. That's 1-800-352-3719.
What is term life insurance? It's basically a financial protection plan for your family if you pass away. It can be a hard purchase. Think about it. It's one of the few major purchases you can make that you will personally never use. But you've got to have it to protect your family. And you owe it to yourself to shop and compare to get the best possible rates. For term life insurance policies of $500,000 or more, call the Term Lifeline today.
800-957-6068. That's 800-957-6068. Remember, we specialize in term life insurance policies of $500,000 or more, and we have great rates for smokers too. So call today. 800-957-6068. 800-957-6068. That's 800-957-6068.
Today, more than ever, Americans need a means to protect their life savings. With a troubled economy and government spending out of control, they've been forced to promote loose money policies, which decreases the value of the dollar and promotes inflation. Birch Gold Group can help you protect your savings by rolling over all or a portion of your IRA or 401k into an IRA backed by physical gold. Take advantage of the best gold prices in years and enjoy the long-term hedge against inflation that gold provides by moving into a gold IRA from Birch Gold Group, the precious metal IRA specialists. Call Birch Gold Group today for a free consultation on how a tax-free rollover to a gold IRA can offer stability, protection, and the peace of mind that your life savings, which you've worked so hard to build, is safe. Call 888-999-1351 and receive Birch Gold's free information kit, which offers the best-kept secrets for safeguarding your savings with gold. Call 888-999-1351. That's 888-999-1351.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems. Listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that may allow is to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. U.S. Tax Shield offers a price protection guaranteed quote to get you protected today. U.S. Tax Shield is A-plus rated with the Better Business Bureau, so call now. 800-658-3876. That's 800-658-3876. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-658-3876.
Biz Talk Radio.
And we're talking with David Priest, the author of a new book, The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. We talked about President Clinton already. I've interviewed Mac McClarty, his chief of staff, who said it was chaos then. But there's an interesting story there about sort of a nuclear alert, I believe, related to the Pakistani prime minister. Mm-hmm. And also they pulled some mock stuff on him, too.
Yeah, the situation between India and Pakistan had really deteriorated in 1999 to the fact that they were shooting at each other across the border. And the Pakistani prime minister had been the one really pushing it and getting into it. He realized pretty quickly that he was in farther than he wanted to be, and he was looking for a face-saving way out. He came to Washington on July 4th, 1999, to try to get Bill Clinton to get the U.S. government in the middle and give him a face-saving way out. Bill Clinton wanted little to do with that. He realized that Pakistan had been the aggressor here. What happened was a fascinating story. Bill Clinton told me that the PDB frustrated him all the time because he just wanted more than it could provide. But he did tell me an especially useful time with the PDB, and it was that day. He said he read a document in the PDB that made it very clear that the Pakistanis and the Indians did not have clear information at all about each other's nuclear intentions. With both of them having nuclear weapons, both of them escalating a war, and both of them not clear about each other's intentions, he saw the writing on the wall and thought that this was a very dangerous situation. In his meetings with the Pakistani prime minister that day, he brought this up and said, "Do you realize that your own military is arming nuclear weapons right now?" That helped enable him to walk the Pakistani prime minister back, to get him to defuse the crisis and perhaps avert a nuclear war.
I was interested, too, that he added economic intelligence to this, which has certainly become more relevant, particularly up through Obama. I have a question on this, which is that he increased the scope of distribution to more folks.
Right.
And which do you see over time? You give it to more folks, which obviously means more of the administration's on the same page. Mm-hmm. But I got the impression that the smaller the group, the more the CIA was willing to share the deepest level of intel. So is there that trade-off?
I think that trade-off is real, and it will always be there. When the president's intelligence checklist started back with John F. Kennedy, originally it only went to John F. Kennedy and then his national security staff immediately serving him. The vice president, Lyndon Johnson, did not see it. That lasted about 6 months. Kennedy realized that his decisions needed other people involved. Some of the top secret material he was seeing, he wanted to have conversations with his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Defense. So he had them added. Interestingly, he never had Vice President Johnson added. So suddenly, after that day in Dallas, Vice President Johnson gets elevated to the presidency. He has no idea there's been this top secret intelligence document going to John F. Kennedy. That's the danger, is if you only release it to a few other people, it limits you as the president because it's very hard for you to have a conversation without a whole lot of backstory with your advisors. Go to the other extreme. If you have a book like Bill Clinton's, which went to a couple of dozen people, President Obama's now, which goes to over 30 people, yes, you can have those conversations with the deputy secretaries of departments and the other people in the government who you might need to talk to. But it means that some of the super secret intelligence might have to be held back because the distribution would expose very sensitive sources and methods to too many people.
It's an interesting trade-off. So what was the deal that the head of the CIA at the time, James Woolsey, I think his name was, couldn't even get an appointment, right, to see Clinton?
Yeah, he was very frustrated with his time as director. A quote he uses all the time is that he didn't have a bad relationship with President Clinton. He didn't have one at all. he tried to get involved in meetings, and he took took part in a whole lot of White House meetings, but in terms of one-on-one with the president, of sitting and really getting him the best from the intelligence services, he felt like it just didn't work well at all for him. So what happened is, instead of focusing on the PDB itself, he started working on getting to other leaders in the national security bureaucracy, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor. Hopefully, if the system works, those people are still getting the president what he needs from the supplementary intelligence to the PDB.
Now, I think this was the first time that Osama bin Laden warnings started to surface mm-hmm. in the PDB. Did the Clinton folks not get it or overlook it, or did they?
Well, I would say that no one overlooked it. That is, it appears as if they read this. You have to remember that every day's President's Daily Brief has several items. It might be 5, it might be 10 separate articles about events in places all around the globe. One particular article on one particular day might cause the president to move the fleet or to order some foreign policy action, but often it's part of a much larger mosaic of stories and intelligence information coming in. The 9/11 Commission did declassify and almost wholly release 2 President's Daily Brief articles, the first time it had been done in this fashion. The first one was from December 4th, 1998, when there was a piece for President Clinton that said, "Bin Laden preparing to hijack U.S. aircraft and other attacks." That one didn't get nearly as much attention as the one that George W. Bush saw in August of 2001, which said, "Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S." Both of them provided a lot of information about what al-Qaeda was interested in doing and what they were preparing to do. Neither one of them had a point prediction of the 9/11 attack. That just wasn't there.
Did the CIA feel that they got unfairly beat up about not recognizing this potential when they actually had stuff in there?
The people that I spoke with who worked on this and were briefing at the time felt a couple of things. First of all, this was what they call now the summer of threat. George Tenet used the phrase constantly. The lights were blinking red. There were plenty of warnings going to all levels of the U.S. government about the terrorist threat. Everybody knew something was going to happen. They just didn't know when or where. The fact is, in the president's daily brief, the president alone can't do much about tactical intelligence and national security issues. Making him aware of bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. was probably a very useful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, you can't expect the president to act on every single piece he sees. That's why there is an entire bureaucracy of other people working in various areas to follow up on issues that come up in the intelligence.
So tell us then, 9/11 has happened, and how did George W. Bush, did he change the way that he absorbed the PDP? Did he make it more intense? And along with that, there's always, you know, the feelings about Cheney manipulating. Did he try and politicize the book at all?
Yeah, let me address each of those. The president, this is George W. Bush we're talking about, he followed the example of his father, and he invited in a working-level CIA briefer to lead the discussion with him every single working day. He didn't just do that, though. He took it up a notch. The first was before September 11th, which is he asked his daily briefer to travel with him even when he was on trips domestically and overseas. No other president had asked the CIA briefer to do that. That is why on 9/11, you will see the picture of Michael Morell, who later on was the acting director of the CIA, but at the time was the president's daily briefer. He is in the photos of the president in Florida when he found out about the attacks. He ended up flying around with the president all day on Air Force One. There's a story in the book about that and how the PDB briefing job ended up becoming almost a liaison of information job on Air Force One itself. The second thing George W. Bush did later in his administration, even after the 9/11 Commission, even after the WMD Commission that revealed some failings in the intelligence dealing with Iraq, President Bush, getting message after message about how badly the war in Iraq was going, would have been understandable if he would have said, "I don't want to hear this anymore, don't brief me." He went the other direction. He actually invited intelligence analysts into the Oval Office more often, supplementing his PDB briefings with what were called deep dive briefings on particular topics, where the world's experts at the CIA and other intelligence agencies would come in and chat with him about it for 20, 30, 40 minutes. So he took it up a notch from even what his father, who had been director of Central Intelligence, had done. On the Dick Cheney question,
yep.
From talking with Vice President Cheney and talking with his briefers and talking with other analysts and managers who supported them, they found him to be a very diligent customer, a very persistent customer, someone who asked a lot of very good questions. they did not feel that he used the word that has come out a lot in the media, which is manipulated the intelligence. He had strong policy views, that's for sure, but he was constantly looking for what does the intelligence actually show, and are we really digging deep enough to find out everything we possibly could? Most people regard him as a very good customer in that regard.
All right, I think this is cool. President Obama is now getting his PDB on an iPad.
Yes, he is. He started it back in 2012. He started getting his President's Daily Brief put to him on that new format. The change from ink on paper to electrons on a screen doesn't necessarily change the analysis within it, but it does open up a realm of possibilities for interactive graphics and other kinds of things that you might be able to do with the document.
But doesn't it give you the option, too? For instance, you could hit a link and go deeper in it as opposed to having to get stuff added into the book.
Sure.
How do they keep it secure?
Well, I'm sure there are very strong technical means to do that, because there is no way the President of the United States is going to be getting this sensitive information unless it is secure. It would surprise me if the President's iPad with the President's Daily Brief on it had the same functionality of a typical iPad that mm-hmm. you or I would use. That's a way of keeping the information secure while also giving the president the information he wants in the format he wants it.
All right. We'll be right back for our final national segment. We'll look at some of the Intel failures and we'll finish up.
Has your life changed? Are you now in a situation where you need health insurance? Here's some simple advice. Call our health insurance hotline right now. This free service will do all the work for you. Shop the health insurance marketplace and find the plan that best meets your health insurance needs. Don't get lost searching for plans on your own. Let a licensed agent help you for free. According to a report on CNN Money, almost half of those eligible for subsidies are paying less than $3 a day for bronze or silver plans. Remember, under Obamacare, most Americans qualify for health insurance. So get ready to let us do all the work for you and find out the best health insurance plan for your needs. Call this number now.
800-659-7975. 800-659-7975. For your free health insurance quote, call now. 800-659-7975. 800-659-7975.
Hi, I'm Joan London. If you're worried about your parent or loved one living alone, like I was, and you want reliable senior care information, then call A Place for Mom, the nation's largest senior living referral service.
Finding an apartment that was on the courtyard with the view of the trees, the view of the ducks, the stream, the creek, all of that, that was what I needed.
You'll get free information on assisted living, Alzheimer's care, nursing homes, even important financial information. Here's the number.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
A Place for Mom is a free service, and you can trust them to help you. So if you're struggling to find reliable senior living information, there's a place for answers, A Place for Mom.
To speak with a local senior living advisor, call A Place for Mom at 800-451-2976. That's 800-451-2976.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. That's 800-430-7570.
This alert just came in. This special announcement is for business owners and leaders of organizations who've been waiting for the right time to build. General Steel has made it impossible to wait any longer with rock-bottom prices that could save you thousands. That's right, General Steel, America's leader in pre-engineered structures,
is offering buildings at prices you will never see again. Don't miss these prices. A 50 by 100 for under $30,000. You heard right. That's 5,000 square feet under $30,000. Manufacturers, if you need a larger building, try a 100 by 100 commercial building for $129,000. You can't afford to rent with these prices. Imagine a 70 by 100 foot church building for under $69,000. With the economy improving and interest rates still at historic lows, you can't afford to wait.
Call 800-605-5370. 800-605-5370. Call 800-605-5370.
How deep in debt are you? $10,000? $15,000? Maybe even more? And every day that goes by, you know what happens. Your debt gets larger and larger and larger. Well, if you've had it with your mushrooming debt problem and the stress it is causing you, make this free call today to the Debt Solutions Network. One quick, no-obligation call is all it takes for one of our partner companies to show you how they can help you get out of debt. So if you have $10,000 or more in combined debt and you want to learn how you can solve it, make this free, no-obligation call now.
800-814-5035. 800-814-5035.
If you are in serious debt, you have to get out of it and fast. Call my friends at the Debt Solutions Network now.
800-814-5035. 800-814-5035. Call us 24/7. 800-814-5035.
Biz Talk Radio.
Our guest, former Presidential Daily Briefer David Priest, our last national segment here. And give us a sense on if there's any commonalities to failures to predict intel. And if you look at Iraq, in the first war, the invasion into Kuwait caught everybody by surprise. And, of course, in the second one, there were no WMD. Can you wrap something around when the CIA is just missing it?
Yeah, there are a couple of elements here. One, first of all, the prediction of the invasion of Kuwait was a little bit better. They knew Saddam was massing on the border, and there's some good information in the book about how they looked at that. Of course, when it comes to a dictator deciding whether or not to invade a foreign country, you can certainly look at all of the military moves. But if it really comes down to his decision whether to do it or not, that's an inherently hard thing to collect, even for a very good intelligence service. Analysis does not only require good collection, however, it also requires good logic, good argumentation, and a good ability to put together the pieces of the puzzle, both that are there and aren't there. That's hard to do. That's hard to do, especially on areas of the world that are difficult to collect on and gain insight into. The commonality on the failures has often been a failure of imagination or a failure to analytically move beyond the intelligence reporting to what else could be going on, that is, alternative explanations.
Oh, that's great. That's where I was actually going next, which is there sort of pressure to be conventional, not to risk making some big mistake, and we do things like consistently overestimate the Soviet economy that was on the verge of collapse at some point. Is there a lack of the creative aspect of analytics?
Yeah, there is that difficulty, and again, attention will always be there in that regard. The more that analysts worry about a manager of theirs or even the president of the United States chastising them for missing the call, the less likely they are to offer those real creative insights that actually inform policymaking beyond just predicting the obvious. It's like swinging a bat to make contact, any contact with the ball, which really fosters a mentality of swinging not to miss. And on the other side, trying for the game-changing home run. Yeah, you'll miss the ball more often swinging for home runs, but when you do hit it, your contribution to the president's decision-making justifies the vast expense of the president's daily brief, much more so than trying to hit singles.
I imagine this has become less of an issue since 9/11, obviously, but are there silos? You've got the FBI, you've got the DIA, the NSA, you've got the analytical and then the operations side of the CIA. How is all that integrated and then reduced to that 20 pages or less?
Well, the biggest change in the PDB came after the 9/11 Commission, the WMD Commission, and that was the institution of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or DNI. The CIA had controlled the president's daily brief from its inception all the way up until then. On that day, it suddenly became a document of the intelligence community, not just of the CIA. Almost by definition at that point, it became a wider document with more input, with more coordination. Intelligence analysts around the community now routinely write for the president in the PDB and coordinate or jointly review products going into it to ensure that we've thought about those alternatives, to ensure that we've given the president the benefit of expertise and insight from all the various pockets of the intelligence community.
So you don't think that putting in that layer of the ODNI, which sort of reduced the director of the CIA, that was an extra layer so much as it was a good value add by bringing more pieces into the pie?
What the people who were involved in this told me for the book was that, yes, the DNI took over the book. Yes, the DNI has been incorporating other points of view from around the community.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the actual production of the book, still a lot of CIA analysis going into it, still a lot of CIA personnel involved in it. Bush himself told me when I asked him, what issues had you noticed when the PDB shifted from the CIA to this new management? And he said, none. He said he didn't remember seeing any changes because, in his words, the CIA analysts were still the briefers.
There's some humor that these folks exhibit, too. They've given some fake briefings, and they found stuff, a note from Jackie in one of the briefings. Tell us some of your favorite ones.
You betcha. The research turns up some real fun surprises. This is a very serious document. Often it's a life or death issue with the analysis being presented within the book itself. But that doesn't mean that you can't have some fun with it. Back in the Kennedy era, apparently one night Jackie wanted John to turn the television volume down because the archivists who were going through his president's intelligence checklists saw that, in fact, there was a little bookmark, and the bookmark was a note from Jackie, handwritten, that said, John, can you please turn the TV down? The humor side is better. A couple of examples quickly from George H.W. Bush and from Bill Clinton. George H.W. Bush was so comfortable with the intelligence, so comfortable with his briefers, that he was willing to do things that perhaps some other presidents wouldn't. One example, in 1990, an election was finally happening in Nicaragua, and Daniel Ortega was going up against the opposition. The CIA analysis was that Ortega would win the election. The president didn't buy it. He read the piece, looked up at his briefer, and said, I'll bet you an ice cream cone that you're wrong. And the briefer, of course, had to take the bet. It's the president of the United States. Turns out the president was right. The CIA analysts were wrong. The briefer came into the Oval Office the next day with an ice cream cone to give it to the president of the United States. The following administration, Bill Clinton, a voracious reader of the PDB, even if he could not keep to a schedule. One day in 1996, on his 50th birthday, he opens up the president's daily brief, and he starts reading about how specific things that he has said and done during the previous days and weeks have led to the eruption of crises and catastrophes all around the globe. He said he got through a few pieces of this before he realized they were pulling his leg, and he said he got a good laugh out of it.
Taking a little risk there in case he hadn't found it funny. Now, you really put a service together because really no one has ever done what you've done, which is to look at the whole thing from the beginning, how it's evolved, et cetera.
True.
Do you have suggestions or that you've heard from experts on, you know, fundamental changes or reforms that would make it better?
In terms of what could be better, it all comes down to the president. If this document is going to be useful for all of the energy and attention that it gets within the intelligence community, it has to boil down to the president himself. President George H.W. Bush perhaps said it best when he said, don't let anybody else tell you what should be in the president's book. Ask the president. And that's what it really comes down to. To the extent that you just rely on chance, not going to work so well. To the extent that you actually get the president what fits his personal style, what fits his needs, then I think it's going to be a success no matter what.
Been a lot of fun to read the book. Delving into all these presidents, it really is talking truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is just out. It's The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. It's published by Public Affairs, which does great books, by the way. Our next show, we'll speak with the president and head of HR at a hedge fund that got its second life after the SEC forced Steve Cohen's SAC Capital to shut down for insider trading. They've now resurrected as .72. We'll learn about their dramatic culture shift. Thanks to David Priest for joining us. Thanks to our national audience for listening. And we're going to see you next Sunday, of course, on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. Biz Talk Radio.